The next case of the morning is number 013916, Gregory C. Pecor against Walls. Mr. Mulcahy.
Good morning, judges. Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Michael Mulcahy, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Gregory Pecor. I'm here today to appeal the district court's denial of Mr. Pecor's petition for writ of habeas corpus. The district court found that the state court had accurately applied federal law, and I respectfully disagree. In 1988, Mr. Pecor was tried and convicted of various offenses, and at the jury selection at his trial, the prosecutor excluded or used his first four of five peremptory challenges to exclude African Americans, including Mr. Chuck Edmonds. Mr. Edmonds is the issue in this case.
I want to ask you a question, though, going straight to the Operation Push point, which was troublesome to the Illinois Appellate Court, and which I understand is one of your principal arguments. It seems to me you are arguing that we must read this record as one in which, at the time of the trial, everybody involved at the state trial thought that when the person on trial was Caucasian and the excluded juror was African American, that was fine, that the Batson rule didn't extend that far. It was before some other decisions had come down. And the effort, seems to me, you're arguing to patch that up later on with new reasons, whether it was Operation Push or being a student or whatever it may be, is already unsuccessful, that this really was a race-based exclusion. Now, if we do take into account the results of the hearings the state courts ordered, we have what looks like a mixed motive kind of situation where there are some reasons, like, what were you doing before you have your present job, student, and that's all he says. He doesn't say student for 2 years or student forever, or he doesn't really expand on it. That might be a perfectly legitimate reason. So what do we do if we see a set of reasons on the table, one of which is troublesome, Operation Push, and one of which isn't?
Judge, I think the court needs to focus on the reasons that he did volunteer to give back in 1998 after he excluded Mr. Edmonds and the other African-Americans, in which he said, basically, Batson doesn't apply. I can exclude African-Americans because the defendant, Mr. Pecor, is white.
But what justifies our disregarding everything that came out in the later hearings? I mean, we do order after-the-fact Batson hearings, and we realize that these are a poor substitute for a good record at the time, but sometimes it's the best you can do. And now we have a bigger record, and I think you're trying to tell us just disregard the whole thing, but I don't know where that is in the law.
Judge, I'm not suggesting that the court should disregard the record. I think in 1988, the prosecutor's true motives were apparent 5.5 years later at the Batson hearing when he did cite two reasons, his employment and student status coupled with his membership in Operation Push, simply were given as a pretext to try to avoid being found to have purposely discriminated against Mr. Edmonds back in 1988.
What your argument does is literally erase that hearing. In other words, there was a hearing. There was an opportunity for that to be the argument.
I understand that, Judge.
And that's unfortunately what you're left with. I mean, I may have the same feeling you do, but where do I go with that?
Judge, my argument is that neither the trial court at the Batson hearing nor the appellate court did a thorough enough analysis to determine whether it was unreasonable to when they decided that it was not a violation of Batson when the trial court excluded or challenged Mr. Edmonds. They did not ever compare Mr. Edmonds to three Caucasian jurors who were allowed to be impaneled who had similar characteristics, similar age. They had similar job characteristics. In fact, Mr. Edmonds had a much more stable employment than two of the Caucasian females who were allowed to stay on the jury.
But none of them had been, had been students for 45 years. Or, I mean, that's what you're left with, the feeling that, you know, this man never got out into the real world.
Well, Judge, I don't think the record supports that. There was a very short question and answer. When the trial judge asked Mr. Edmonds what he did for a living, he indicated that he'd worked for the Chicago Transit Authority for 8 years as a ticket agent. The next question was, what did you do before that? He said he was a student. One-word answer.
Response with one word. That's the problem.
That's the problem. I recognize that, Judge. But for the trial court and the appellate court to leap to the conclusion that he'd been a student for 45 years, or a professional student, this man had served in the United States Army, he had a son. There's nothing in the record to indicate that how long he'd been a student, what jobs he'd held before his time with the CTA, and for the trial court and the Illinois appellate court to jump to the conclusion that a professional student is some kind of instability in the community, it's just not supported by the record.
Well, certainly empty out Hyde Park. But actually, no, I have two questions for you. One are the notes that Judge Dwyer took on which he relied at the Batson hearing, part of the record, or do we have only his testimony? And the second, you did mention his Mr. Edmonds' military service, which obviously does suggest that there was a period of time of his adulthood that he was not a student. Is there anything else in the record to indicate there are other similar periods of time?
We do not have Judge Dwyer's notes in the record, and Judge Meacham, the trial judge, specifically ruled that they were not to be included in the record.
Okay.
So all we have is the testimony of Judge Dwyer at the Batson hearing.
Okay.
What I think the problem that the trial courts failed to do was to compare Mr. Edmonds, and I want to simply compare him to Mr. Foley, two virtually identical individuals, except one is African American, one is Caucasian American. They both served in the United States Army. They both were into physical fitness. Mr. Foley, the man who was allowed to stay on the jury, had been a beer truck driver for 12 years. The state never inquired into what he did before his time as a beer truck driver. Mr. Edmonds had worked for the CTA for 8 years, and the state asked what he did before that, and he said he was a student. So we have Mr. Foley, who had been a beer truck driver for 12 years, who at the time of trial was 55 years old, and the state had no idea what he did before that time. And we have Mr. Edmonds, a 53-year-old African-American male, who had been with the CTA for 8 years and a student immediately prior to that. They are two similar situated individuals. The characteristics, my brief is replete with the similarities between Mr. Foley and Mr. Edmonds. Mr. Edmonds was peremptorily challenged. Mr. Foley was not. When he was peremptorily challenged, the prosecutor admitted that he did not think Batson applied. Only 5.5 years later do we hear that the reasons for his exclusion were his membership in Operation Push and his student employment experience that somehow he felt was lacking. We feel that the state courts, the trial court and the Illinois appellate court, failed to reasonably apply federal law. And we request that this court reverse the district court's ruling denying Mr. Pecor his petition for a habeas corpus, and we ask that you grant it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mulcahy. Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Your Honors, counsel, my name is Russ Benton. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General. In this case, the trial judge conducted the voir dire hearings and credited race-neutral reasons for striking juror Chuck Edmonds. That finding of no purposeful discrimination is fully supported by the record and is entitled to great deference, and this court should affirm the district court's findings and deny habeas relief. In federal habeas cases involving Batson, there are actually two layers of presumptions against the petitioner. There's the Williams v. Taylor presumption of unreasonable application standard, and then of the law cited, Hernandez versus New York and Batson, where after a third stage hearing in Batson cases, the findings of the trial judge are given a clearly erroneous standard. The burden is on the petitioner to overcome these hurdles, and as the trial court found, the prosecution's reasons were race neutral, and district court found that the state court correctly applied the law to the facts. This court should affirm.
Mr. Benton?
Yes, Your Honor.
If the Illinois Appellate Court, as you know, was troubled by the Operation Push reason, because whatever else you may say, it's an organization that is identified very strongly, I'll put it that way, with the African-American community. Would you say that the court should have looked to see if this really was a proxy, I'm excluding you because you're African-American? I mean, suppose the issue had been gender discrimination, and you had somebody there, you know, that man who runs the Augusta National Golf Course or some such person who is very out front on his views that women don't belong there. Some organizations are really the same thing as saying you stand for a certain viewpoint. And what if Operation Push is a proxy for saying this is an African American, therefore I'm keeping them off?
Well, Your Honor, to answer that respectfully, and I don't particularly want to compare it to the Masters analogy, Operation Push is identified as an organization of African Americans, but it is also identified as an organization that is very liberal. Not all members are African Americans. And it is also identified as an organization, rightly or wrongly, that has very strong feelings and is circumspect about the death penalty. And this case, when it was in the Illinois courts at that stage, was a death penalty case. I don't think mm-hmm. you can say, well, this Operation Push, that's a proxy for racism. I think there were other reasons. And in fact, you questioned why the trial court didn't look more closely to that. Well, what happens, and what we would present as a reason they might not have, is that after the Operation Push, after the assistant state's attorney brought up that reason, when they went back to the defense counsel at the time of the Batson hearing itself, the defense counsel clearly stated, and I'm looking at Exhibit B of counsel's appendix, page S70 or page 69 of the transcript, where counsel in fact said, and this is defense counsel, we don't see the Operation Push as a race-related reason. So in fact, if counsel at the time says, you know, we don't consider it like that, I'm not sure there's a burden then on the court to follow up. In essence, they may be stopped, and whether that's true or not, it's his own counsel that said, I don't think that's a race-related reason. So there's really no point after that for the court then, if counsel doesn't consider it and is not going to bring it forth to the judge's attention. I don't know if there's a reason why the court needed to look at that point.
And how do you think a court should approach a case if two reasons are stated, one of which would be a race-related reason, and the other of which is a benign reason?
Well, I mean, if the
what kind of mixed, basically, what mixed motive analysis? Do we do something like Mount Healthy against Doyle? Do we do, what approach do we take if there's one reason that
we I think if the court finds, and I'm not sure this is the proper court to do it in all respect. I mean, there have been layers of courts up until this point, the trial court, the appellate court, the PLA that was denied, and the district court all found it wasn't a did not find inherent discrimination. If, in fact, there is one reason that's neutral and one reason where there's an overt inherent discrimination, I think it's very, you know, you have to look very strongly to see if there's been a Batson violation. I certainly don't think those facts are inherent here. And, in fact, after so many layers have looked forward, I don't think that this court can find that there was inherent discrimination.
So what would happen if someone said, well, he's African-American, and he's been a student for 45 years, and that really worries us. What happens to that?
They simply say the phrase, he's an African-American. Oh. Well, that's pretty I think you have to look at the facts. You have to look at other facts when you make that analogy. You have to look at the facts of the other jurors in the veneer.
But haven't we just done away with Batson?
I don't think we've done away with Batson at all. In a lot of the cases this court has found, and I'm thinking of Mahaffey, and I'm thinking of the case last summer.
Wrong person to talk to about that case.
And Henderson, those were cases where we didn't even have a prima facie case. And in those cases, all of the members of the minority were replaced. In this case, you end up with a jury that is 42% African-American. You end up with a prosecutor who leaves half or six of 14 peremptory challenges in his pocket. So I don't think, based on those facts, I don't think you can find inherent discrimination. And to answer your case, I think you mean, with all due respect, I think you need to look at the broader the picture of that jury, of those circumstances. I mean, in this case, we did have a Batson hearing, and the court did come up and reach its third stage, which is due great deference, whereas opposed to some of the other cases, there are not. And I don't think the trial court's findings, as this court has said before, as long as they're race neutral, there's no basis for a reversal unless it's outlandish or the evidence is clearly false.
So it wouldn't be outlandish to get up and say, well, he's African-American, and he's gone to school for 45 years. That's not outlandish.
Well, I suppose it could be, depending on the tone of what happened. I mean, the jury, you're building a record, and, if you're looking at race-neutral race, it may be the fact that that's not race-neutral reason, even though you're simply saying it, you're not saying anything else. And then the court, again, at that point in the third stage hearing, it very much holds on the assessment of the credibility of the prosecutor, of the credibility. And that's almost a view of the trial judge's demeanor. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Hernandez. I could see in a situation like that, it might be considered not a race-neutral reason, but if you have to look at the big picture. I don't think in this case the trial court's findings were erroneous, as the appellate court and the district court have clearly found that they were race neutral. I think there are other reasons. One can look at the Operation Push. I think the burden always falls on the petitioner, not only in this kind of case, but in habeas cases in general, whereas when counsel says, well, the record is kind of sketchy, the burden never falls on the prosecution, especially in Batson cases and habeas cases. I don't think, as I said, I don't think the trial court's findings can be found clearly erroneous after the third stage, nor do I think the state court unreasonably applied clearly established federal law to the facts. So as the trial court's findings are due great deference, and there were race-neutral reasons stated, we would ask this court to affirm the district court. And if you have no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benton. Mr. McKay.
Thank you, Judge. I'd simply like to follow up on Judge Rovner's question. If a prosecutor says he is excluding an African-American panel member because he is African-American and because he's been a student for 45 years, we may as well throw Batson out.
Why isn't the proper approach to do something like a Mount Healthy analysis and say, but for the forbidden reason, would they have done it anyway and put the burden on the state? I mean, that's what happens in other areas. I mean, we need to look for guidance. Putting to one side the question whether that's this record or whether this court could create that rule in the absence of the Supreme Court, those are separate issues. But don't you need some kind of structure for mixed motives?
And, Judge, to be honest with you, I don't have an answer for that. What I think in Batson, when a criminal defendant, and in this case Mr. Benton recognized, was on trial for his life, the state is obligated to try him with a jury that has not been impaneled with racial motivations, any racial motivations. I recognize Batson discriminate upon a basis of race. But any discrimination that includes race is a discrimination that includes race. And here, whether it's Operation Push or whether he actually says, I'm excluding Mr. Evans because he's African-American, it's the same thing. Mr. Edmonds was excluded because he was African-American in violation of federal law. This court should reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Pecor's habeas petition and grant him habeas relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mulcahy, and a special thanks to you since you are an appointed counsel. We very much appreciate your time and your firm's willingness to take on this case and having rendered such fine service for your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.